A lot of books come across my desk, and I've got one that I got to recommend to everybody. It's called Intercepted, The Rise and Fall of NFL Cornerback Daryl Henley. And the author of this book is a contributing writer to Sports Illustrated, Michael McKnight. This is his first book. But if you don't know the story, the book is about Daryl Henley, a former professional football player who played with the Los Angeles Rams. And Henley went from being an NFL rising star in the early 90s to a federal inmate in the span of only 3 years. Now, he was a star cornerback for the Rams, as I said, when he met Rams cheerleader Tracy Donahoe, and at the same time he bumped into a boyhood friend, Willie McGowan, a one-time youth league standout who since turned to drug trafficking. And from there, Henley, Donahoe, and McGowan embark on a scheme to transport cocaine that lands Henley in federal prison. And from prison, he attempts to arrange a mafia hit on a sentencing judge and the star witness against him, Donahoe, and Henley is currently in prison serving a 41-year sentence. Michael, what was it that attracted you to this story?
Well, I think just the marriage of NFL cornerback by day and drug trafficker by night. It just, I don't think we'd ever seen that before, and that was what he was charged with, and it turns out that that wasn't quite the case, but just the initial headlines were really hard to resist. You know, kind of a Tony Montana Scarface, you know, slash Daryl Green, Deion Sanders. It's not very often that those two worlds collide.
What was the case then?
Well, Henley was charged with masterminding a cocaine trafficking scheme, and he, you know, all of the evidence and all of my work and even all of the stuff that was presented in trial in 1995 show him as not being the mastermind of it at all, but kind of being a willing participant. Daryl was made fun of growing up and during his college career at UCLA and even as a member of the LA Rams as being a square. He was a nerd. He grew up, he was raised in parochial schools in the suburbs, and his parents are still married, and, you know, his older brother has a degree from Stanford and a master's degree from UCLA, and his younger brother is really well-educated and super bright, and he's not the prototypical cocaine trafficker. And he ran into some friends that he knew as a boy. He hadn't seen them for 15 years, and one thing led to another, and Daryl, being naive, and even he'll be the first to admit he was stupid at the time, said yes to some things that he should never have said yes to, including helping his friend, you know, financing his friend's attempt to send a suitcase full of cocaine from Los Angeles to Memphis, and then another one from Los Angeles to Atlanta.
The one thing that jumps out to me is it may be one thing to be trafficking in cocaine, but another to attain, try to set up a mafia hit on a sentencing judge and the star witness is the thing that surprises me. That seems to be consistent with being involved with the cocaine, but yet it's contrary to what you just said about him from a personal standpoint.
Well, the charges that I just described and the incident wherein he agreed to have a federal judge murdered, that those things happened 3 years apart. And in between was a very contentious, bitterly fought, high-profile trial that you and I and everybody else never paid any attention to because O.J. Simpson was standing trial in Los Angeles. You know, Daryl Henley stood trial about 20 minutes south of that in Orange County. And his trial was a photo negative of the O.J. trial. And Daryl stood trial and was judged by people who were predominantly white, whereas O.J. Simpson was judged and eventually acquitted by people who were almost exclusively black. And there was lots of problems within Daryl Henley's trial. And the book goes into great detail, but the most jarring of which are that there was one juror who admitted to being strung out on methamphetamine during the trial. There was another juror who called the defendants a racial slur that starts with an N during the trial. And so by the end of when the verdict was delivered, and Daryl Henley stood trial with four others, he was the hardest defendant to convict. All of the jurors said so. He was the most difficult one in terms of the evidence for them to convict. He felt like he had been done wrong by the system, and there's a very strong argument in support of that based on the jury stuff that I just explained and other issues in the trial, including a prosecutor who had once clerked for the judge, the presiding judge. So Daryl was dangerously angry at the system, and you know, none of these things condone what he did in terms of approving this mafia hit on the judge and on the star witness, but they certainly help explain it. He was dangerously mad at the system. He felt he had been wronged. He had been raised to learn that he deserved a fair trial. He did not get one, and so this mafia person starts calling him while Daryl is awaiting sentencing and offers to put together a drug deal for Henley to help support his fight for a new trial, and as part of that says that, hey, we'll take some of this drug earnings and we'll turn it around for you and we'll knock off this judge and this cheerleader. And Henley is reluctant at first, and over the course of a few conversations, he agrees to it. And that mafioso person ends up being an undercover DEA agent. So that's kind of how that all wound down. But it was not a short process. It was a process that included and it was informed by the legal proceedings that came before it.
It sounds like to me, off of what you said about the things that happened with his trial and some of the things that were said, that there would be plenty of grounds for appeal, which would probably either get it overturned or at least another trial. Why didn't that happen, or has it been happening?
It hasn't been happening, and there's a couple reasons why. One, Darryl stood trial, again, like I said, with four co-defendants. Each of those other four co-defendants are walking around just as free as you and me today. As soon as the verdict was delivered in the initial drug trial, Darryl Henley filed a motion for a new trial based on everything I just told you and more in terms of the jurors being less than perfect, and the system that convicted him having been less than perfect. And his motion for a new trial was very, very strong, and there's a very strong argument to support the fact that the prosecution and the federal authorities helped, you know, quote-unquote, dirty Henley up, make him a little bit dirtier by having this DEA agent call him and offer to do away with the judge and the star witness against him as a means to put away any hopes of a new trial once and for all. Darryl Henley's four co-defendants each won their motion for a new trial. As part of Darryl Henley's plea agreement in the judge murder case, he gave up his motion for a new trial, and that's why he's still in prison today. If he had not given that up, then he would have gotten a much longer sentence than the 41 years he was given. It's a complicated kind of a circuitous story, and I hope I've done a good job of explaining it in the book. But the nuts and bolts of it are that Darryl Henley made an awful mistake in 1993 when he got mixed up with these former friends of his, and from there on it was a three-year process of him trying to claw himself out of that hole. And instead, he just got much deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper until he agreed to do the unthinkable, which was to take another life.
You mentioned about the effect of the O.J. Simpson trial and the dichotomy there. Also, the fact that he was a pro athlete, did that factor into the whole circus atmosphere around this?
Definitely did. I've interviewed more than 100 people for this book, you know, including DEA agents and prosecutors and everyone else. And the glare on the O.J. Simpson trial, I'm sure everyone can remember just how white hot it was. It's the highest profile trial in history. And, none of us were paying attention to these issues that were happening in this other trial that was happening 20 minutes south of it. At the same time, you know, Darryl Henley was an NFL player. The prosecution's eagerness to get him, because he was famous, because he, you know, seemed to think he was above the law, you know, that it made them more excited about convicting him, and they expended all their resources to do that. Plus the fact that he was wealthy. He was a wealthy defendant, and wealthy defendants hire very, very good defense attorneys usually. Darryl Henley hired two very, very decorated, respected defense attorneys, so the federal government and their prosecutors, you know, ramped up their efforts to convict him. So very much so, to answer your question, the fact that he was an NFL player definitely played a part in his trial and conviction and everything that followed that, too.
Tell us a little bit about him as a football player.
Well, Darryl Henley was a first-team All-American at UCLA. He was a first-team All-American in 1988, the same year that Deion Sanders was the other starting cornerback on the All-American team. And they were actually friends. They met each other at the Kodak All-American festivities that offseason in Atlanta, and they could not have been more different. Darryl Henley, as a football player, was a student of the game. He studied. He was only 5'9" and 170 pounds. He was the smallest defensive player in the NFL at the time. He studied. He was smarter than the receivers that lined up across from him almost always. And, you know, this isn't me talking. This is, you know, dozens of football players that I've talked to, his teammates and guys he played against. He crafted himself into an NFL player, which makes what happened to him later even more sad, because his success in the NFL was a byproduct of his hard work. And he crumpled it up and threw it all away. But, Darryl Henley played for some awful teams in Los Angeles. The Rams were very, very bad. Their last year here in 1994, before they left for St. Louis, was the worst year in franchise history, and he was one of the few bright spots on that team. It was just a lot of kind of forgettable players and a 3-13 season. But he was a small player who made the most of what talent he was given, and he was always devoted to learning more about the game, studying film, studying his opponents, learning how receivers ran routes, and trying to get an edge on them based upon what was between his ears, as opposed to maybe his speed or his leaping ability or something like that.
Yeah, you know, Michael, a lot of people will be hearing this, but, I mean, this is a kid that did not come from the inner city. He was raised in suburban Los Angeles. He was raised by supportive parents, educated at a boys-only parochial school. He had an All-American career at UCLA. He was a rising star in the National Football League, so most rational people would say, what was the attraction for him to get into something scummy as drugs and doing something like this?
Well, it's a fair question, and it's a good one. And it's something that Darrell Henley doesn't even have an acceptable answer for. The culture at that time was interesting in that, 1993 was white when Snoop Dogg was starting to, gain some sort of fame, and gangster rap, quote-unquote, was ascending to the top of the charts and, kind of being cool and hip-hop hard and, walking the line between crime and, being straight was an appealing part of, pop culture at the time. Whereas 10 years earlier, it was 1983 and gangster rap wasn't really a part of our society. Again, when Darrell Henley was a 4 or 5 year veteran in the league, there's lots of guys who, like him, who were raised on the right side of the tracks, so to speak, who their teammates and their friends kind of laughed at him for being square. And this was Darrell Henley's opportunity to do something, illicit and countercultural and risky and dangerous. And again, he's the first person to step up and admit now that he was an idiot for doing that. It cost his family more than you could possibly quantify. His parents are the real victims here. And so the allure was just walking on the wild side for a little bit. He had no idea that it was going to end up the way that it did. And, of course, he had no idea he'd end up serving 41 years in prison. At the time, it was just his friend saying, hey, if anything goes wrong with this airplane trip and this cheerleader that's flying from L.A. to Memphis, if something goes bad with that, can you pay the guy that I got this cocaine from? Can you make sure that I'm not going to be in trouble? And Darrell's like, yeah, as long as my hands are clean, I can help you out. If something goes wrong, I'll help you out financially. I don't want anything to do with it. I don't want to gain any money from it. I don't want it to be connected to it in any way, shape, or form. And from that point, everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong.
We have about 90 seconds left. Explain the involvement of the Rams cheerleader Tracy Donahoe in all of this.
Well, Tracy Donahoe was 19 years old at the time. She was born and raised in Orange County, a white girl. She and Darrell Henley were not boyfriend, girlfriend, but they were romantically involved and, slept together, just to cut to the chase. And Darrell Henley's friend, William McGowan, who was a drug trafficker, asked Darrell Henley if he knew somebody who could make it through a few airports with a bag with some bad stuff in it that wouldn't necessarily be noticed. Someone who could make it through security checkpoints and the like without, raising any red flags. And Darrell Henley's like, absolutely, I kind of know someone who would fit the bill. And that person was Tracy Donahoe. And, part of the trial was based on whether she knew she was carrying cocaine a lot. And she said that she did not know. She thought she was carrying cash, but there's just loads of evidence to support the fact that she did know what she was carrying. And at the end of the day, she was sentenced to 4 months in a halfway house. She never served any prison time, whereas everyone else was convicted to 10 years or more in federal prison. So that's one of the more interesting wrinkles in the story.
We have 30 seconds left. What do you want people to take away from the book, Michael?
That's a good question, and the answer is this, is that if it can happen to Darrell Henley, it can happen to any of us. And there's a lot of people who may listen to this and be like, absolutely not, no way, I would know better. But, Darrell Henley's education, his parents, his upbringing, everything else speaks to the fact that he was not immune to this. And again, if this upstanding young man who had a B average and a history degree from UCLA and the respect of his teammates and everyone else, if this could happen to him, then the rest of us are at least susceptible to it. So I think that's the lesson to be learned.
Well, Michael, congratulations on this book. I'm looking forward to reading it, and I'm going to urge other people to as well. It's called Intercepted, The Rise and Fall of NFL Cornerback Darrell Henley. Thank you, Michael, for joining us, and come back and join us anytime here on Sports Byline.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Michael, contributing writer at Sports Illustrated. We continue on Sports Byline.